Okay, I'm going to call the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology for April 6, 2017 to order. And we're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 87. I'm going to open that public hearing. Sean?
Certainly, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. Just a quick refresher, Senate Bill 87 grants the state grants the state chief information officer some discretion to relieve state contracting agencies and public corporations from the obligation to obtain quality management services when implementing IT initiatives with estimated costs that exceed $5 million. It also reinforces the state CIO's authority to require agencies to obtain quality management services for those IT initiatives with estimated costs that are below $5 million when certain criteria are met. So again, just provides that additional discretion to the state CIO to be able to make decisions, not just based on dollar amount, but on the relative risk of the project.
Thank you. I think this is going to be a short public hearing. Nobody signed up. Does anybody on the committee have anything for this? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 87. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 90.
Certainly. Senator Riley, members of the committee, just one second, and I'll give just a very brief refresher on Senate Bill 90. Senate Bill 90 transfers information technology security positions and functions that currently reside within certain state agencies within the executive branch to the state chief information officer. It also establishes the Oregon Cybersecurity Center of Excellence within the Office of the State CIO. Finally, it does establish an Oregon Cybersecurity Fund and continuously appropriates monies that may end up in the fund to the state CIO for operation of the center.
Thank you. So I'm going to ask Jim Gardner, Keith Brown, and to come on up. Thank you.
And gentlemen, if you could remember to state your name for the record before you begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for Microsoft. We simply want to state our strong support for this bill and also in particular for the Cybersecurity Center of Excellence. This is an essential function of our IT economy and our IT infrastructure, and it makes all kinds of sense to centralize that function and to stay on top of the currency of the threat as well as the ways that we can counter it. So we're in full support of this bill.
Senator Riley, members of the committee, my name is Keith Brown. I'm with the Technology Association of Oregon. I'm also the co-chair of our cybersecurity lab at the Technology Association of Oregon. As you know, I think the Technology Association of Oregon has been a very strong advocate of this from the very onset. We believe that this is an important bill for the state, an important bill for the Technology Association members. We think that there's enormous opportunities for the Technology Association, our members, and the local education community to collaborate in ways that help us build skills pipelines that are significant and, quite frankly, much deeper than we have available to us today. So when we look at the opportunity of having a center of excellence within the state, we see it much more broadly in terms of its impact, in terms of the technology community, and our ability to find the skills that we'll need to grow our businesses and support our businesses as we go forward in time.
Questions for these two? Yes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question. Regarding the Technology Association of Oregon, I'm sorry that I'm not familiar with, did you call it the Cybersecurity Lab?
Yes.
Is that a physical space or is it a virtual lab, meaning it refers to people coming together to discuss and work on the topic?
It's the latter. It's a virtual lab infrastructure. What we try and do is gain access to local experts, create a a group of people who can be used as mentors, advocates, who can answer questions for a variety of people, and we have a small contingent of us in that cyber lab that work with a variety of people around the community.
Thank you.
Representative Nierman.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question for you is, first of all, thanks for your presentation, but why doesn't the industry association have ownership of the Center for Cyber Excellence? Why does it have to be the state that does that? Or why is it better that this?
Why is it better? I'm not sure I can answer that, sir, for the Technology Association. I can answer it, I guess, as a personal belief. The ability for us to reach all businesses in Oregon is important, especially when you think about cybersecurity and the changes that we're seeing in business infrastructure. A point-of-sale device today is now your smartphone. So as we think about, you know, technology in the security space, it needs to be much broader than a single technology association. It needs to be something that we can point to and provide resources to the broad range of industries in this state, not just the technology industries that are maybe more well-versed in cybersecurity and cyber technologies. So that would be my personal answer to you, sir.
Thanks.
Senator Linthicum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up Co-Chair Nathanson's question with regard to this being a virtual place, given that it is virtual, the idea, I guess this may correspond with Nierman's question also, the idea that it is housed in one location doesn't really provide any leverage by location in that sense, I'm meaning within the state. All of these technologies are widely available. There, a lot of them are open source. Some of them are proprietary in the Microsoft arena. Because there are access points to all of these, I'm not sure I see the value of the Center for Cyber Excellence being housed within state government.
Mr. Chair, should I take a crack at that? There is a precedent for this at this federal level under NIST, which is the standard-setting body. There's a cybersecurity excellence center, and it seems the consensus is, I believe, that it's worked pretty well. I think that since a lot of the cybersecurity risk that has been perceived is at the within state government, it certainly makes sense for the state to participate as both a customer and a collaborator, I think, in terms of dealing with that risk. I don't see this as exclusively I see it as a public-private partnership, certainly not exclusively a state function, but where the state would actually act as a convener, much as NIST does at the federal level.
And NIST is a standards board, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so setting standards is different than housing a Center for Cyber Excellence. Just make that note.
Well, may I?
Yes,
please. Senator Lithgow, I think that to build on what Mr. Gardner has just said, it's also the collection of the expertise and resources. And by having a center of excellence within the state, you have a set of competencies, a set of capabilities, best practices that are easily shared or more easily shared with a much broader public set than you would if we did this as a standalone center, sir.
Great.
Follow on with regard to that, one of the things you mentioned was building a skills pipeline. I don't recognize easily how the Center for Cyber Excellence and what you just alluded to in terms of having that skill set widely available does to help your industry in terms of building skills pipeline, how those individuals, quote, get into the pipeline, get moved out of public sector into private sector or vice versa, et cetera. All of those features of Cyber Excellence Center have not been explored or defined and are very vague. Last week, I referred to this as a big fluffy kitty, and we hope there's a kitty in there somewhere. But this is very, very, very large concept. And I'm trying to put boundaries on it and recognize where those land. Can you offer me details?
I think the opportunity in this collaboration, sir, comes between the industry, our education resources, the community colleges, the four-year institutions, the ability to, quite frankly, give them real-world problems to work on, something that may indeed be the genesis from, or have a genesis from, the Cybersecurity Center, the ability to more actively share programs and information through the center, I think, is another example of how this may manifest itself over time. There's an opportunity, sir, to create a much stronger collaboration across our education institutions as well as within the industry. And to me, that's the key element of a center for cybersecurity excellence that's missing in any other component.
Go ahead, follow up.
Probably the last follow up. With that regard, do you see cyber excellence and opportunities and development blossoming spontaneously in the market and in the scholastic arena, et cetera, or being directed from state government? And if state government does it, I see it getting bogged down. I see the university system and community colleges being more on top of it than state government and blossoming in their own ingenuity and creativity. That's how the entire internet is just exploding on the scene.
Yeah.
And I would expect that was a better approach, having all of those universities contribute in that fashion, maybe a clearinghouse or a collaborative effort, but certainly not a directional effort.
Sir, if I may.
Please.
I think that the opportunity you have to recognize here is that can be a two-way collaboration. Just as you say, the universities need to be the place where the ideas are spawned, but there's an opportunity to work in collaboration with our local government, with the industry, to prove those ideas as well, and not necessarily prove them in a production environment, but to look at the problems that are being addressed at the state and local level and look for opportunities within the development pipelines at the universities themselves to address those. We can spawn new industries, we can spawn new curriculum, we can spawn new projects within those teams, and I think you would see an acceleration of capabilities within the state as a result of that.
Mr. Chair, if I can also add a little bit of that. You know, I don't see it as an either-or situation at all. I mean, you remember the Internet, you know, came to life as a result of a DARPA project. It was DARPANET originally. And it's we've had other examples of that with our great national labs, with Los Alamos and Sandia. So I don't see it really as directive, but more as convening and bringing to bear both academic resources and industry resources to collaborate. So that's my view, at least.
Other questions? Thank you very much. And I think maybe our next person will shed some light on that, Dr. Machuca. And could Charlie Kawasaki come up as well?
And gentlemen, if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Wayne Machuca from Mount Hood Community College.
I'm Charlie Kawasaki, also from the TAO, and I have several students who will testify with me in a few minutes as well.
Oh, okay, great.
As I said, I'm Wayne Machuca from Mount Hood Community College. I am the lead instructor and primary investigator for Oregon's only associate's degree in cybersecurity. And Senator Linthicum, I want to acknowledge you for asking some really fabulous questions, and you're really on point with exactly what some of the concerns are. And so what my commitment is to this committee is that keep those questions in mind, because I think I've got a pretty good answer for you that might satisfy your need. As I stated, we have at Mount Hood the only cybersecurity degree program in the state of Oregon. Let's check that, cybersecurity associate's degree program in the state of Oregon. It has been acknowledged by the Department of Homeland Security and the National Security Administration with the Certificate for Academic Excellence for a two-year institution. We are one of only 30 community colleges on this planet that have that accreditation. And what that means is that our program has reached a level of national proficiency in the development of cybersecurity professionals. Now, we are seeing a particular problem in the cybersecurity employment realm in this country and, of course, across the world. And that is that there are far more cybersecurity job needs than there are people to fill those spots. Now, we're seeing some really interesting numbers, whether we're talking domestically or internationally, but the Bureau of Labor Statistics is telling us that within the next 2 years, fully 46% of all cybersecurity jobs in the United States will be unfilled. Now, what that means is that we've got an amazing demand for professionals and no supply. And what that does is it creates a cybersecurity professional whose income level is way high. In fact, we're seeing the national averages right now for a bachelor's degree and 4 years of experience being somewhere around $150,000 to $170,000 per year, and that's the average. Okay? So what that means is that all of everybody's staff is at half capacity, and they can't even find the people to fill in the other half. All right, now this is a problem. And why this is a problem is because we're seeing this in Oregon as well, where if you're going to create some cybersecurity protection, you're going to need the manpower, the person power. And if you want to go out and recruit that, what you're not going to find is someone with a bachelor's degree and 4 years of experience in a CISSP who's going to come work for you for $70,000 a year. And if you do find that person, you better do two background checks on them because there's something wrong. Now, what is also so is that we are creating at Mount Hood quality cybersecurity trained technicians who can do the daily jobs, who can do the log reading, who can do the network development, those kind of tasks that you don't want to give to somebody who's making $170,000 a year. And they'll do it for a whole lot less. And what else is so is that this year, Mount Hood Community College will be putting out about 40 new cybersecurity graduates. This is going to be our largest graduating class ever. Now, this is pretty cool because what we have been doing with Stefan and Alec is making a commitment to create an inflow of tactical, technical, trained cybersecurity individuals who can satisfy the entry-level needs for your workforce at the state. It's not bad. And we're doing one more thing. Part of the COE has given us the vision to realize that the cybersecurity needs will not be limited just to the executive branch, but have to be extended out to the citizenry of Oregon. And so what we're looking at is the creation of something that Stefan is referring to as the Civilian Cyber Corps. That is, trained technical people who can provide for the cybersecurity of needs of Oregonians. And what Mount Hood is committed to doing is creating a module of that at our campus in Gresham, Oregon, where we will train people to support the state, but also support the state initiatives with the local citizenry. Now, there's more. And what's more is we've committed with the CIO to create this as a module that can be replicated across the other community colleges who want to participate. That is, we can leverage the existing power of the existing cyber programs at community colleges or enhance those programs readily to provide a workforce for you that will be, well, almost never ending. Now, this is really cool because what we have done in cooperation with Charlie, and I'll turn this over to him in just a moment, with Charlie and Tao in our Small Business Development Center, is we've created at Mount Hood a small business cybersecurity task force. And who these people are individuals who are trained to go into small businesses and provide advising and basic education to small business owners in cybersecurity. And maybe it's things as simple as, you know, change your password, back up your data. Maybe don't use your cell phone for banking, if you know what I mean. Okay? And so a lot of what we're looking at, ladies and gentlemen, are things that we are already producing at a small scale, but can amplify up to serve the needs of the state. Now, we think that the passage of SB 90 is something that would help us develop that type of a workflow, that kind of a training flow. So when, Senator, when you speak about the blossoming is occurring right now, and it's occurring at Mount Hood. And that blossoming is transferring into Oregon Institute of Technology. When they develop their new cybersecurity degree, which will be released in September of 2018, and now we can see the real path of a real bridge, of a real workforce going really to work for you, really.
and that's what we're about. So I heartily endorse that you, I have to say that again, I heartily encourage you to endorse Senate Bill 90. And for my own part, I ask you to consider increasing funding for community colleges. And you can't do that, at least increase funding for Mount Hood Community College.
Wrong committee, sir.
Wrong committee.
But you do have the co-chair sitting here, so.
All right.
Not a bad audience.
Thank you very much. I turn this over to my friend, Charlie.
Great. Thank you, Wayne. And if the committee would indulge us, I'd like to invite the two other students with me. Would that be okay, Jim?
So, would you have any other questions for me?
No, thank you very much. And yeah, if the students could come up, that'd be great.
Great.
Bring a chair forward.
Again, my name is Charlie Kawasaki. I'm part of the TAO's Cyber Lab. I'm also involved with Wayne Machuca at Mount Hood Community College on their small business cybersecurity clinic, helping advise small businesses to improve their cybersecurity needs. And I'm also the founder of a cybersecurity camp for high school students. We're here to heartily endorse SB 90 as well. We think that there are things that the state can do that uniquely the state can do. And those things include your convening power to help some of these budding initiatives grow and succeed statewide and deliver benefits to many unserved communities within the state that small organizations like ourselves simply can't reach by ourselves. So I would like to talk a little bit about the cybersecurity camp, which is in our second year. And for that, I'm going to turn this over to Xander to start. Xander, would you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Xander Work. I'm a senior at Lake Oswego High School, and I am one of the co-founders and instructor at the PDX Cyber Camp and intern at Pacific Star Communications working on their cybersecurity. So the camp, we're in our second year, and we'll have three sessions this year, one at Mentor Graphics, one at
the Center for Advanced Learning in Gresham.
And then the third will be at the Lincoln High School in Portland. It's a week-long introduction to cybersecurity for high school students entering grades 9 through 12. And I wanted to help work with this camp because I've learned a lot about cybersecurity through various internships that I've been able to secure. And I want to be able to help give back to other high school students that are looking to learn more about cybersecurity and get involved with this once they graduate from college or graduate from high school and go straight into the workforce. And we wanted to put on this camp because there's not a lot going on for cybersecurity at the K through 12 level. And we wanted to provide an on-ramp for K through 12 students to have a little bit of an introduction to cybersecurity before going into college or the workforce and know a little bit more before they enter cybersecurity programs at the higher education level.
Great, thank you.
Hi, I'm Amelia. I'm a junior at Lincoln High School. I'm also a co-founder of the PDX Cyber Camp. And I'm an intern at Formal Tech Incorporated working on some active cyber deception software. And what I want to talk about is how cybersecurity as a field is really great for women. And I see that there's a lot of potential for women to go into it and to help the field grow as the field itself grows in Oregon. And I'd really like to encourage that there be some female surrounding programs that help encourage women to go into the STEM field and that cybersecurity doesn't pass us by once again. And to help with this, I have encouraged the PDX Cybercamp to create a girls-only session this year. And there is a girls-only session, and it will be at Lincoln High School in Portland. And it's going to be run by female instructors, and it will have female cybersecurity guest speakers that will educate the female high school students about what it's like to be in cybersecurity field. And I'm really interested in helping recruit girls because whenever I'm in a computer science class or in an internship, I'm commonly like the only girl or one of two, and it's very sad, and I really want more girls to come in. And so I'm really excited to be teaching at the girls-only session of our camp.
Oh, thank you, Amelia. My two students here were instructors last year and were founders of the camp and have been instrumental in recruiting students to join us. We are intending to serve 75 students this summer, and it's a combination of hands-on curriculum as well as a remarkably, really a surprising degree of involvement from industry, with industry speakers coming in and industry sponsors to making the camp happen. Of course, it's really just a couple of volunteers, and this is a program that we would like to see expanded statewide as well, because it's there's quite a bit of potential, and it's well beyond our meager spare time means to by ourselves. So to follow on with the comments that Wayne made earlier, Professor Machuca, I should say, according to cyberseek.org, there are 4,800 open cybersecurity positions in Oregon right now. So while he graduates 40 qualified students this year, and we're very excited about it, that's just a drop in the bucket compared to the need. And those cybersecurity positions in Oregon offer several things. One is the ability for our educational institutions to create more programs that fulfill that need and deliver a valuable service to our citizens here in the state. It's also indicative of how hard businesses are struggling to fill those positions and to meet their cybersecurity requirements. In addition to that, even the companies that are large enough to create their own cybersecurity infrastructure and develop a sophisticated and trained cybersecurity staff, there are very large segments of our businesses as well as our local governments who are very underserved and underprepared to meet their cybersecurity needs and defend against modern day attacks. In particular, small businesses are one of those areas. They tend to be very underprepared, and it's very expensive to try to meet the defensive needs of cybersecurity for small companies, particularly when the professionals are so rare to come by. Now, what you've seen today are a couple of examples of budding programs that we think have great potential to have an impact here in the state, and that's one of the reasons why we're so excited about a cybersecurity center of excellence in combination with the private sector, with the educational community, as well as with the state itself, to help us really consolidate and help grow these budding programs into something that can be applicable statewide. I guess the last thing I would have to say is that with support from the state, I think that we can make a big difference, and I'm hoping that you support this bill.
Questions? Starts Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really, really quickly, do you take any measures or do you have any policies in place to keep someone who's from the dark side or to keep someone from getting some information and going over to the dark side or whatever?
Well, the good thing about this camp, it is strictly defensive technologies and defensive techniques. So we're not teaching any attack methodology whatsoever. The curriculum that we are using is based on a curriculum from the Air Force Association, and you can think of it as like early training for the exact skill set that you would want for someone in your IT organization to make sure that your systems are secure. So at the end of the week, there's a competition not to break into the banking system. It's a competition to see who can make the most secure computer systems, and they're graded by that.
Thank you. Senator, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speaking for all of the women on this committee.
And the most and the most important member of the committee.
I would like to say to all of the women on this panel for public testimony, I want to offer my congratulations and strongest enthusiasm and encouragement for your work.
Thank you very much.
Other questions? So I want to just go along with what the representative was saying and say I'm really pleased to see two young people here so interested in this field and you know, ready to go out and change the world and make things better. So I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So first of all, is there anyone else who wants to speak on this bill?
I think we have two more folks here.
That was these two.
Oh, that was us two. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, great. Oh, you're right. Yeah. Perfect.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you.
So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 90. And, Sean, do we want to do the retirement system?
Sure. Before you open the informational meeting, mm-hmm. Senator Riley, members of the committee, wanted to also remind you that in addition to the public testimony that was given here, we did receive written testimony from a variety of folks. That all of that testimony is associated with Senate Bill 90 on OLIS. If you go into the meeting materials tab, currently we have testimony and or letters of support. All of them that I'm going to list are supporting the bill from the Oregon State University, from Multnomah County, from CompTIA, from HP Enterprise,
more of an informational, a kind of a trends in the government sector, kind of a five-page letter from the National Governors Association. We do have complimentary written testimony from the Technology Association of Oregon, from Mount Hood Community College, and also one or more private individuals who have submitted testimony in support of the bill. So I just wanted to make sure the members knew that.
Sure.
So certainly we can move to informational meeting if you'd
like to. Okay, so I'm going to open an informational meeting on the Public Employees Retirement System IT overview.
Jordan, thank you for being here, and if you could remember to introduce yourself for the record when you begin presenting.
Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Jordan Misanga, Chief Information Officer with the Public Employee Retirement System. So there's a number of slides I'm going to unpack, so I'll try to go through quickly. So I want to present the IT organization at PERS and the strategies and how it's aligned with the agency strategies as well as the state strategies. The PERS mission statement is we serve the people of Oregon by administering public employee benefit trust to pay the right person the right benefit at the right time. The ISD, which is my division that I run, our mission statement is to enable the satisfaction of PERS members. We deliver quality services to agency stakeholders by providing accurate information and superior products that support decision-making and daily operation needs. Here's the organization chart at PERS. The large box on the bottom is the division. I am the Chief Information Officer. There are three sections or departments within ISD, the Technical Operations section, Enterprise Application, and Enterprise Content. I do have a couple of other groups that work directly with me, Enterprise Architecture and IT Administration. Within that is Information Technology Project Management and IT Quality Assurance. So at the glance here, as far as staffing, there's about 379 staff at PERS. 75 of them are in ISD. So that makes about 20% of all staff that are working in ISD. The ISD staff to management ratio is about 19-1. 29% of the staff provide application development and maintenance of the system. 28% provide system infrastructure and support. 30% provide enterprise content management. And 13% provide project management and quality assurance services. So, as I mentioned, they are organized in three sections and one admin group. There's about 75 folks in the ISD organization. Here in this slide, it just breaks down their functions within their own divisions. I'm not going to go through this in detail, but it just shows that we're covering all the bases as far as IT within PERS. So really quickly, some of our major accomplishments this past biennium, or this current biennium, the TOS has been really busy with updating a lot of the internal supporting systems, including middleware and also rolling out service-oriented architecture. We've upgraded a number of systems internally, as well as developing a centralized data warehouse management system. Enterprise application is really focused on the daily operational need of maintenance and enhancements. They're also involved with the big project that we're working on, which is the IEP administration project, as well as embarking into a DevOps strategy. Enterprise content management, they're continuing to really align the skills of ECMS with new technology and rolling out our five-year strategy. They've been busy with capturing 100% of member documents and centrally workflowed into business activities. As far as budget and expenditures, here in this graph here you can see a four biennium trend. In this past biennium, ISD percentage of the total LAB is about 25.4%, which is about 2.7 reduction from prior biennium. If you drill into that, we're spending about $1.1 million in in personal services, and $11.2 million in services supply, and $14.9 in capital outlay. So a little bit about the system in PERS. We have a term for it. It's called ORION, Oregon Retirement Information Online Network. It's basically a system that consists of a number of components, such as our retirement application, which is called JClarity, our content management system, which is IBM FileNet, our data warehouse, call center, and general ledger. The core functionality that ORION provides our staff is really, the core is retirement administration. So data collection, calculations, payment processing. We also have portals into that system. One of them is called OMS, which is the member portal. The second one is EDX, which is the employer portal, which they report their wage and contributions of members. And the third is the third-party administrator, which is the portal for the TPAs. Governance, IT is fully governed by a number of groups. The budget that I do have is really governed by these groups. The first is the executive leadership team, oversees the PERS enterprise. The PERS board, we do have to have the board approve major IT projects. The PERS Information Security Board oversees PERS information security and IT and non-IT related activities. The Project Steering Committee, which prioritizes and allocates resources to enterprise projects. The ORION Steering Committee, which prioritizes business and business related IT change requests and releases for ORION. And then the Office of State CIO in regards to overseeing large projects through the stage gate process. This graph just basically shows how the governance is organized within PERS. As you can see, the purple boxes are the external governance over my division. In this slide, it seems a little intimidating, but it just kind of shows the IT impact of all these projects to my organization. It goes back all the way back to the 2003-2005 biennium, where we had a major PERS reform called HB 2020. It just shows that also, you know, they're not stopping. There's a lot of changes going on, and it's impacting my organization. The colors really just shows the footprint of this impact to the organization. The blue circles really shows that's the where the majority of the work is, the majority activities, and I expect to continue to seeing that. The light blue circles at the end there is the current POPs that I'm working on. POP 104 and 105 is to resolve the technical debt within ORION, as well as our disaster recovery planning. So what happened was back in 2004, I really wanted to understand the business perspective of what IT is really needed for PERS. So what I did was I pulled the key business together into one room and spent a whole day trying to figure out where the capabilities are needed within PERS. So we decided that there are really five capabilities that were identified: service-oriented staff, an agile technology system, data management and analytics, adaptive governance model, and then organizational change management. So those are capabilities that we walked out of that meeting. So we took that and really drove the strategic plan for the agency. We took that information and really tried to answer the question, you know, if we were exceptionally good at delivering our mission, where will we be as an agency? What services will we provide to better support our members, and how will we get there? So out of that question, we came out with four strategic pillars. The first is organization management and development. member services and communication, data reliability, and then information governance and security and technology. I'm going to focus on the last one here because that's my strategy for to support the agency. So the PERS and IT strategic plan, so those two needs to be aligned. So my job was to develop an IT strategic plan that aligns with the agency's strategic plan. So out of that strategic plan for the agency, we really identify these areas. A focus area, goals, objectives, and strategies. We knew what they were, but what we didn't know was what are the planned action and process measurements for those strategies. So what we did was we took the first there are a number of focus areas within the information governance and security technology strategy. The first is IT governance and management model. We did a lot as far as identifying what we need to build a strong governance framework. And at the bottom there, it just shows what the related measures are. So when we have the strategies and we build these plans to execute upon these strategies, we want to make sure there are related process measures. As far as projects and initiatives, for this objective, we rolled out COBIT and ITIL, ITSM framework. And then for this objective, we rolled out enterprise architecture and ITSM. The last objective is the same thing. So we really put together a framework that supports the strategy for IT governance. The second focus area was agile technology systems. So this here is to really trying to improve IT efficiency and responsiveness to our business, to my business. Again, we have related process measures that align to that. The first initiative was in 2015-2017 was POP 104, and that was trying to address the technical debt. And then for 17-19, POP 102, which we'll be introducing, we will be focusing on modernizing our Orion system. And then lastly, for this objective, adopt a scalable system development lifecycle. We've implemented agile methodology, DevOps, and IT bimodal. Last one here is information security. The goal there is to establish an information security management system. In this upcoming biennium, we will be introducing POP 101 cybersecurity, which is something that we have planned. That should meet all three objectives, which is establishing information risk assessments, establishing risk security treatment process, and developing and establishing information security organization structure. There is a last one. This is disaster recovery. In the 15-17 biennium, we did introduce POP 105 disaster recovery. We will be continuing to focus on that in the upcoming biennium as well. We have two objectives there. We're hoping that this POP 105 and also the continuation work for the next biennium would satisfy these two objectives. So I also want to show how the PERS IT strategy aligns with Office CIO alignments. I think about a month ago, we had the Administration and Business Services Information Resource Management overview by the Strategic Technology Officer. Just want to show that the strategies align with the Office CIO. The Strategic Technology Officer lists out four goals or strategic goals. The first is customer focus. Second is sustainability. The third is enterprise focus. And the fourth goal there is information technology strategy and governance. So my first initiative or my first focus is really trying to make sure all our initiatives align with the Office CIO. In this chart here, it shows that some of the current and planned projects that we have does align with those strategic goals. The first three The first one is the IEP administration into Orion, which is a current project that meets the customer and sustainability goals. The second one there is the PERS cybersecurity program that meets the sustainability goals. And Orion Business Modernization Program is also planned, and that meets the customer and sustainability goals. And lastly, the data center migration, which is the data disaster recovery, meets sustainability enterprise-focused strategic goals. So as in conclusion, I wanted to just wanted to emphasize that IT really aligns itself very well with the agency strategic plan, as well as the Office of CIO Administration and Business Services IRM plan. And I strongly support the PERS mission, and as well as my own mission. So that was very quick. I wanted to pause and take any questions you may have.
Don't see any. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, George.
Thanks.
Senator Riley, members of the committee, next up we have the Department of Administrative Services. They'll be giving an information technology overview and also give a high-level overview of the Human Resource Information System project, which we may bring back to this committee. If not, it certainly will be heard. Its budget request will be heard in the General Government Subcommittee coming up in a few weeks. So if you could remember to introduce yourself for the record, and thank you for being here.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Brett West. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the Department of Administrative Services. Today we'll be giving you an overview of DAS IT, the internal IT shop that provides support to our agency, as well as the HRIS program. On the second slide here, you'll see the DAS mission, and our IT shop is heavily focused on making sure that their actions address the mission of the agency. The five, I guess those are octagons, around the mission are the areas of focus for our new director, Katie Koba, and we have those as part of our lens through which we deliver on the mission.
Actually, hexagons, but that's okay.
Hexagons, thank you. I can't count from this side of the table, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. With that, I would like to turn it over to our internal CIO, Gina Salang. She will be carrying most of the weight today.
Thanks, Brett. Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Gina Salang. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Administrative Services. This is my first time presenting to a legislative committee, so please allow me to apologize in advance for
You'll do fine. Don't worry about it.
Any missed protocols. And please
don't worry about it.
Yes, thank you. So this is our organization structure at DAS as it relates to IT. We have three primary divisions, HR, finance, and administration. And then my organization reports directly to the Chief Administrative Office under Brett West. And I also have a dotted line relationship to the state CIO, Alex Pettit. That's mostly to ensure alignment with enterprise initiatives, directives, and enterprise strategies. But my focus as the internal CIO is really to serve DAS and DAS's needs. In this next slide, this shows the two sides of my house in terms of information technology. It's pretty much divided between a software focus and a hardware focus. So on the application delivery side, these teams focus on providing support to the business divisions of DAS based on the platforms of those systems, so either mainframe or web-based. And then on the technology support side, it's really your traditional help desk. Infrastructure is really like the behind-the-curtain back-end support, like spam filters, coordinating with the data center on servers, networks, big data kind of issues. And then our desktop support technicians provide support to all parts of DAS on site. So whatever can't be helped by phone, we would deploy the help desk or the desktop support staff. And then these strategies, Jordan just touched upon them. The first four are in direct alignment with OSCIO's strategies. These are identified in the Information Resource Management Plan. We've added a fifth for cybersecurity, and that's mainly we want to show that we're in support of the governor's executive order on cybersecurity unification. And you know, we internally are focusing on strengthening DAS's information security program. We conducted a self-assessment with Gartner. Even prior to the executive order, we've initiated a security project to really address any items that need remediation. And recently, the Enterprise Security Office published new standards, so we want to make sure that DAS complies with all those standards. This is our governance structure. So the Department of Admin Services has an executive management team. They're the final stop for IT policy decisions and funding decisions. Under the exec team, we have an IT advisory committee, and this is a joint committee made up of both business and IT representatives. And this committee serves really to do that legwork for the exec team to make the recommendations or to research anything that comes from the exec team in terms of IT in that space. We have our three divisions again. And then I show this different, the cylinders say embedded application support, because we do actually co-locate developers within the business divisions they serve. And then we have this technology support that's centralized. These are the people that are housed with me over in the General Services Building who provide centralized support to the department. And then here's us by the numbers. So I have a small shop. There's only 40 of us. But together, we have over 700 years of experience. And that sounds like a lot. But actually, if you divide it, it's only like 17 years per person. So it's not that bad. My budget is $12 million by a biennium, which actually represents 1% of the agency's budget. And I know that that is pretty lean. But I feel like we run lean, but we also extend ourselves by partnering with the business, partnering with our partners in the OSCIO. And also, if we need to, we can seek vendor resources or, supplement ourselves that way as needed. We also provide support to 10 client agencies, small boards and commissions. So we do help desk and desktop support. These are pretty small boards and commissions. So as an example, Board of Accountancy, Criminal Justice Commission, Employment Relations Board, Board of Optometry, pretty small boards. Together, if we add all 10 up, there's about 200 customers in that space. And then, again, some more numbers. DAS is really, Department of Admin Services really has big systems. We process payroll, have the system of record for payroll for the state. Most of our financial transactions are mainframe-based, lots of big mainframe and financial payments. We've also provided, I think it's in your packets, a handout of DAS's major systems, and you have that as well for your reference. And then just a little bit about our projects. I will defer on the Human Resource Information Systems project to Madeline Zeich, our Chief Human Resource Officer. But the other two projects are, they're smaller projects, non-stage gate projects, but they still are going through that oversight of the IRM or the IRR process and the business case process. So they still are going through that process. And both of these projects are to upgrade systems. The print management system is a 10-year-old system. And this is in our print plant. So the print plant prints all of the state's paper that are statutorily required to be printed there, like DMV titles, DMV registration. So, our print plant serves state agencies, and so we want to make sure that our systems are current for them, and this upgrade gives us a greater ability to serve them. And then with parking, that system also, we're looking to upgrade systems that serve state agencies and state employees. This includes our parking space management, carpools, smart commuter, pretty much the programs that directly serve state agencies and state employees. We are looking for a vendor-supplied system to do all of these things for us. And that's all I have planned to present.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Riley, members of the committee, we now have Madeline Zeich, who will come up and talk about the Human Resource Information System project. While Madeline is coming up, I wanted to emphasize that, as Ms. Lang indicated, we did post a separate document with a list of about 20 to 25 systems on OLIS in the OLIS materials section for today's meeting. The systems that likely will be replaced by this particular project are 25 to 30 years old. So just to give you some context. If you could remember to introduce yourself for the record, that would be great.
Awesome. Good afternoon, members of the committee, co-chairs Riley and Nathanson and Mr. McSpadden. I'm Lisa Sumption. I'm the director of Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, but today I'm here as the co-sponsor of the Human Resource Information System, just so you perspective. So we thought it was a little important to give you where we are, so you better understand why we need to go somewhere different in the future. This is the current state of the state. This is a system that we use. It's a mainframe application, very manual, very, you also use it, actually, or your staff use it. It's very prone to human errors. It's getting really difficult to find folks that can support it, program for it, secure it. From a recruitment standpoint, it's really difficult for us to recruit new folks into the HR world where the first day on the job they see the system and they're first they look at their desk and they go, that's like a handheld phone with a cord on it. And then they see this with a little blinking cursor and lots of just there's 17 different codes just for brand new appointments. There's 14 codes for terminations and they're all very confusing. And it has very limited functionality, so you'll hear as we go along that many agencies have created workarounds and shadow systems, if you will, to be able to create the functionality they need to run their business. So we're going to take you through just kind of a real quick process, and this is just from the point of offer. This isn't from the recruitment standpoint, all the steps that go there. We figured this would be enough to probably bore you to death. But so from the time that you're accepting a job offer with the state of Oregon, you now have paper that is required to be completed. And those are things like your I-9 and more of the legally required documents. And so then if you're an agency who has parking or we all have these nice little badges, these all require a piece of paper. There's many other things. So there's more paperwork that needs to be completed. If you're an agency like Parks, we're very seasonally staffed. We're all across the state. So that paperwork has to go from, let's say, the Cove Palisades via shuttle, via mail into headquarters. And then we process the paperwork there. So additional paperwork may need to be completed, like background checks and all that good stuff. And then there's a personnel action form. Did we actually have one with us?
I don't know that we brought one today.
Okay, so then there's a personnel action form. It's really hard to see on there on the side, but it is this very antiquated long form with a whole bunch of form fields. That all that paperwork that we just talked about has to be entered by somebody manually, and then it actually gets entered into the system. And we call that a personnel action form. And that information is very prone to human errors. And sometimes this information is lacking. It's inaccurate, and it has to go back out to someone to be recompleted or request to come back in. So finally, once everything's available, it can be entered into that green screen system that we showed you just a few minutes ago. And then sometimes this will take hours, sometimes it's days, sometimes it's weeks, depending on. So for us, from an agency standpoint, we bring in about 600 seasonals a year. When we hire them, and these are usually returning folks, when we hire them at the beginning of season, this all happens. And then at the end of season to terminate them, this all happens. And so the inefficiencies from trying to bring on a workforce and take off a workforce is very. So we are, from an agency perspective, are very excited about the opportunity to increase the efficiency. So I'll let Madeline talk a little bit more about the program, unless you have questions about the antiquated.
Okay. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Madeline Zeich. I'm the Chief Human Resources Officer for the state of Oregon. Good afternoon, Senate Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, committee members. I wanted to tell you a little bit about where we are now. So I think some of you have heard of this project before. It's been in planning for at least 3.5 years. I've been here 3 years of them. But if we talk to our Chief Financial Officer, George Naughton, he said he has a file that goes back to 2007. So I think there's been a recognition for a long time that this is a system that needs to be replaced, and now we're before you with an actual plan. I also wanted to recognize a couple of people that are out there in the audience, and that's Twyla Lawson, who is our business lead, and then Joyce Martinez, who is our project manager. So if I turn around and wave at them because I need more information than what I have, please understand that's what I'm doing. They're here with us today. So a little bit about what we've done so far. As you'll see up on the chart, we've completed the business case for this project, and we really see this project as being business-driven. As you heard from Director Sumption, we've had a lot of agency involvement in all of this. We've met with agencies many, many times to not only to design the requirements, but to include them in the selection of the system, and I'll get into more of that in just a minute. Another thing that we have learned, and I actually came from the state of Nevada, where we had some projects that didn't go so well, and I've heard rumor that Oregon has had some projects that didn't go so well also, but also some projects that have gone well. So we really focused on learning from anyone that would talk to us, especially a couple here in eCourt, and I know the Revenue Core replacement is one that's gone well. What are the best practices, and what should we be doing, and what are the risks and pitfalls? We've done that also with our QA vendor, Gartner, and other states. So we've really focused on best practice. We developed some guiding principles that we met with the enterprise leadership team of the state, which is the 21 agency directors, to make sure that everybody was on the same page, that we were going to change our business practices and we weren't going to change a system or build a system around lousy business practices. And then we've been through stage gate 1 and 2 of the OSCIO. We've completed the LFO readiness assessment, meeting with Mr. Cummings on a regular basis. And so all of those foundational documents have been completed. In addition, we recently completed the Oracle assessment that was a new requirement by the OSCIO. That was completed by Dye Management, who did our initial business case. They've come back with a recommendation to continue to stay the course of moving forward with a SaaS, and we received approval of that document from the OSCIO. We have a steering committee from 11 agencies and all three branches of government. So you heard that all three branches use this system. It isn't just an executive branch system. And we rotated in a project team from agencies. We've pulled 11 employees there. As I mentioned, we have QA through Gartner, independent QA, and we also have QA from the Office of the State CIO. A little bit about how we've selected the proposed solution for consideration. We released our RFP in July of 2016. We had 5 proposals. We had 20 evaluators that came from, again, different state agencies. We had a couple demonstrations from top vendors, sent a group to a site visit to see how the systems actually worked live and in person. We issued the notice of intent to award to IBM for the Workday product in November of 2016. And the IBM Fit Gap, the IBM Workday Fit Gap, February of 2017 was our completion of that. I mentioned we've completed the Oracle assessment, which was a side-by-side comparison of Workday versus Oracle PeopleSoft. And stage gate 3 will be requested very shortly. We have 2 more items to do before we can request stage gate 3, one of them being finalizing the negotiation of the contract over the next couple months and getting to the plus or minus 10%. Our timeline, I think I went through this already, so I'm not going to read through it again. But as you can see, we're on time. We're actually a little under budget because we've been trying to hire people just in time. You can see you're on here for the presentation to this committee on April 6th, and we're moving forward with the remainder of the activities with authorization. A little bit about the project cost. Agencies know that this is in their budget. It's been put into the assessment. We're requesting $18.5 million for implementation and software in the 17-19 biennium. We're also planning or requesting to carry over $3 million of the amounts that we hadn't spent previously. And our expected implementation right now is fall of 2018, but I want to put a bit of a disclaimer on that because we're not finished with contract negotiations, and we want to make sure that we have a reasonable implementation time plan. So we'll have more information for you, I think, very shortly. And then after that, our ongoing request, because it's software as a service and we'll be buying a license with just a couple of employees, is approximately, again, we're negotiating that, but $2.6 million per year moving forward. Okay, so impact of the failure to act. I love this little car here. institutional knowledge costs. So I have two people that have agreed to stay on this project that actually built helped build the first project. One person has 40 years. She just turned her 40. Another person, she has 38 years. And then the COBOL programmers that we have, one has 35 years. So we're in a situation where we're losing that knowledge moving forward. And we're also finding, and so Bob Cummings and I often have lively discussions about this, but, you know, young people come up, they don't want to learn how to program in COBOL. Don't know what that's about, but we have a hard time finding COBOL programmers. Agencies have shadow systems out there, and so they're looking for ways to get data and information, and so they're building their own, and so we don't have one user-friendly system. There's increased risk of data security, and of course, inconsistent reporting. When I have to get numbers together for the legislature, it's absolutely embarrassing, quite frankly, and for anyone else, because the reporting takes so long. And then, of course, we'd lose our vendor and contract pricing, and some risk to stakeholder confidence, because I believe this is the third time we have tried this. Is that right, Lisa? Okay. Okay, and then a future state, so here's where we're hoping to go, is that we'll have a modern HRIS that provides improved employee productivity, is user-friendly, allows us to comply with changing legal requirements in the HR world. There is always something changing, and so we'll be able to quickly do that. Something that's flexible, that has standard business processes based on best practices. For example, the system that we've selected is used by Intel and Amazon, larger counties, other states, so we'll be able to collaborate on some best practice work there. Self-service functions that we don't have right now, as Lisa mentioned, all of these are our data entry forms, and establishes really a foundation for the state moving forward. And then one last thing I will say is that this will give us an opportunity to have regular scheduled updates because it is a SaaS and they're released every 6 months. So we won't need to bring on a number of programming staff and have our own hardware. So I think that was all I had for you today. And if you had any questions.
Questions? So the one thing I wish is that you'd quit calling COBOL systems antiquated.
We'll work on that, Senator Riley.
So thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, Ms. Ike indicated that this is not the first time that the executive branch has proposed replacing the human resource information systems, and/or the individual applications that comprise this program area. In part, the last two substantive efforts were in 2007 and 2009. If you kind of think about the financial climate during that period of time and the size of these kinds of systems, a modern human resource information system for an enterprise as large as Oregon could cost anywhere between $20 and $40 million. Both the executive branch and the governor's office had to make some hard choices during those periods of time, and ultimately the funding was not provided for those earlier efforts because of revenue downturns, among other reasons. So I wanted to make sure you had that context. Also, I think it's fair to say that if in fact the project had been funded at those during one of those time periods, it would not have been a software as a service solution. The state of Oregon would have had a legacy system that it would be now maintaining and supporting that would be nearly 10 years old, 8 years old. So there anyway, there are pros and cons to delay sometimes.
So the COBOL systems did a good job.
It has. It continues to do a good job 28 to 30 years in. Mm-hmm. That's right. Great. Anyway, just wanted to provide you all that context.
All right. So I'm going to close this informational hearing. And anything for the good of the order, I'm going to close the meeting. Thank you very much.
So I really regret I missed.
Just wait.